And now, Virgin Most Powerful Radio is pleased to present Hands-On Apologetics with renowned Catholic author and apologist, Gary Machuda.
Welcome, everybody. Hands-On Apologetics coming at you. You have entered into Virgin Most Powerful's Apologetic Zone, where we discuss how to explain, defend the faith with clarity, charity, and confidence. Yes, it is time to enter into the dojo. And I guess if this is the dojo, I'm your sensei, Gary Machuda, your friendly host, apologist, and just all-around good guy. And we've had some really good programs, and yesterday was a fun one for those who missed it. It was Fight Night in Leipzig, Germany. Yes, yesterday was the 500th anniversary of a really important debate that took place between Martin Luther and Catholic theologian Johann Eck. And Luther made some very important denials, denied that councils and popes, they said they could err and have erred. He also, in the second Leipzig disputation, which actually yesterday was the 500th anniversary, that's where Martin Luther basically demoted the Deuterocanon, those seven Old Testament books that Catholic and Protestant Bibles, Catholic and Orthodox Bibles have in their Old Testament, but are missing in Protestant Bibles, or most Protestant Bibles. Martin Luther demoted them in that debate. And so that was a lot of fun. We had William Albrecht on, and William's no stranger to debating, and it was kind of fun to break down that debate. Well, today we're going to kind of follow along the same path. This is purely God's providence that it happened this way, but we're going to have historian Steve Weidenkopf come on the show. And you're familiar with Steve. He's done lots of work with Catholic Answers, Catholic Answers Press, and he has a new book, which we're going to talk a little bit about on the program. But we're going to focus in on the Protestant Reformation. So we're going to kind of fill out some of the area that surrounds that debate, what happens afterwards, and all that good stuff. And that's really something I think every Catholic should at least have a working knowledge of what went on. So when we talk to our separated brethren, we can have a better sense of their history. So that's going to be great. Steve's going to be coming on the other side of the break. Also, we have our Finding the Fallacy. Our Finding the Fallacy for today is cherry picking, which I think is kind of a cool thing for summer. It actually kind of fits. And also the Meet the Early Church Father. And the Early Church Father for today is St. Sophronius of Jerusalem. So good stuff in store for us today. It's time for me to give a shout-outs for all those watching live stream on Facebook and YouTube. Hello, everyone. Great to see familiar names there in the chat room on YouTube. And, yes, they're almost up to 3,000 subscribers. So if you're on YouTube and you're watching live, you might want to click the subscriber button. Then you can get warnings on whenever some great programs are in store for you from Virgin Most Powerful Radio. And hello. Thank you for the emojis, everyone. And I also want to welcome you listening on radio or podcast. It's great to have you on board. Have you in the dojo ready to work out and become a defender of the faith. And as always, your input is appreciated. So perhaps when Stephen Weidenkopf comes on the program, you may have a question. Definitely give us a call because Steve can handle pretty much any question concerning history. Trust me, the guy knows a lot. A phone number to call is 888-526-2151. That is 888-526-2151. And like I said, I'd love to hear from you. Or if you want to send us an email, maybe you have questions, maybe you want to share something that's going on in your life, a scenario, a situation where you're talking to people. We have some awesome emails waiting on the on-deck circle, I guess you could say, for the show. But we could always use some more. And hopefully sometime next week I'll be able to get to the mailbox. But shoot us an email at questions@handsonapologetics.com. Love to hear from you. And also, by the way, I should mention this, and that if you maybe can't catch all the program, maybe there's a program in the past like, wow, I'd really like to hear that fight breakdown, the debate breakdown that we had yesterday. Well, jump on the internet and type in virginmostpowerfulradio.org. And you have access through that website, and also, by the way, on the podcast, or excuse me, the phone app, all the podcasts you can listen to, you can call up, you can share it, you can do all sorts of great stuff. And by the way, since the summer, you know, we do operate with donations. If you want to help support us at Virgin Most Powerful Radio, you can also make a donation online on the website, and we appreciate any help you can give. All right, so let's jump to the finding the fallacy for today. Finding the fallacy is what I said, cherry picking. What is the cherry picking fallacy? Well, it's basically a suppression of evidence. It's a fallacy of incomplete evidence, which is basically pointing out individual cases or data that confirm a particular position or opinion while ignoring a significant portion of related cases or data that may contradict the position. In other words, you pick all the sources that you like and you ignore a more significant portion of the data that speaks against the evidence. And this is a very, very common fallacy, folks, when you're explaining defending the faith. It happens all the time. Happens a lot with the early church fathers. Sometimes somebody will say the early church believed X, and they'll cite two or three fathers, but you know what they don't point out is that a vast majority of fathers would actually disagree with that position, or you know, there was something wrong with that position. I mean, this happens a lot, like with the Deuterocanon, for example. There's four or five early church fathers that didn't include the Deuterocanon in their canonical list, the Old Testament Deuterocanon. And Protestant apologists focus on only on those. But what they do is they ignore all the other church fathers. And in fact, there are other writings of those four or five where they use these books as inspired scripture. So that's a great case of cherry picking right there. So whenever you're using data, I mean, the rule of thumb is you should make sure that you present all the data, or at least if you can't present all the data, at least let people know that there could be data that contradicts what you say. So it's just, you know, disclose everything, folks. That's the bottom line for that fallacy. All right, let's jump to the Meet the Early Church Father. And today's Early Church Father, not exactly super famous, nevertheless, a very important early church father named Saint Sophronius of Jerusalem. Sophronius is Patriarch of Jerusalem. He was born in Damascus about the year 560 AD, died in Jerusalem 638 AD. He's known as Sophronius the Sophist, although, you know, many times when you hear sophist, you think that's actually kind of derogatory, but not in his case. He was actually an instructor of rhetoric, and instructors of rhetoric were many times known as a sophist, so it actually isn't a pejorative. It's a good term. In this case, at least, Sophronius also was a monk in Egypt about the year 580, and afterwards at the Jordan Monastery, and still later at the Theodosius in Jerusalem. Let's see. He was a friend and companion of John Moshkosh. I'm not sure how to pronounce that. On his journey to Rome, and he dedicated a wonderful work to his friend John, known as the Spiritual Meadow. Now, how Sophronius fits in the church history is, well, he was an ardent defender of the Orthodox faith, contending against the heresy known as Monothelism. Monothelism, of course, is that heresy in which some people believe that Jesus only had one will. Okay. And the Orthodox, the correct position is that Jesus, having complete and full divine nature and complete and full human nature, has a divine will and a human will. They are both in union with one another. Well, the Monothelites said, no, he only has one will, a divine will. So Sophronius was he was the one that campaigned against that heresy. And although he wasn't always successful, already in 633 AD in Alexandria, he went up toe-to-toe to contest the Orthodox faith with the Monothelite patriarch, who is Cyrus of Phasis. And his mission there, unfortunately, had no success. But months later, he also undertook the similar mission to Sergius, who is the Monothelite patriarch of Constantinople. And Sergius plays in big time, folks, with the whole case with Pope Honorius and Honorius's kind of vacillation on the question of how many wills Jesus has. Well, upon being made Patriarch of Jerusalem in 634, Sophronius immediately drew up a synodal letter in which he explained at considerable length his doctrine of the two energies or operations in Christ. And though it's usually called a synodal letter to Sergius of Constantinople, it's probably just an open public letter that he wrote defending the Orthodox faith, not only against Sergius, the Monothelite patriarch, but to anybody who was interested in the Orthodox faith. So Sophronius is a warrior, folks. Although not always successful, he always was faithful. And so that is why he has an ST before his name, is St. Sophronius of Jerusalem. His death, he died roughly around AD 638. And historians, at least Jurgens, points out that his death was probably hastened by the tragedy of the fall of Jerusalem a few months earlier by the Caliph Omar. So when Islam moved into Jerusalem, scholars believe that hastened Sophronius' death. So that's our Meet the Early Church Father today, St. Sophronius of Jerusalem. And, I love the Early Church Fathers because they give us a witness to the earliest faith. They tell us, give us a snapshot of all the controversies going on in their age. And also they are great exemplars for us to follow. And that's certainly true with St. Sophronius. On the other side of the break, folks, we're going to have master apologist and historian Stephen Wadenkopf to talk about the Protestant Reformation. You don't want to miss it. Stay tuned. You're listening to Hands-On Apologetics.
This is Terry Barber reminding you, there's a women's conference coming up September 7th, 2019 at the Sacred Heart Chapel. Mary Danielle Barber will be speaking along with Barbara Nicolosi. They're going to be talking about true femininity, be who you are. This is going to be for your daughters, your mothers. Every woman should be at this conference. And the way to do it is go to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
And welcome, everybody, to Hands on Apologetics. Well, we are, like I mentioned, Monday, that was the 500th anniversary of Martin Luther's rejection of the Deuteronomy Canon at the Leipzig Disputation. In fact, it also was the last day, 500 years ago yesterday, of that famous disputation. And we talked a bit about Martin Luther and Johann Eck and a little bit about the historical context. But we left a lot out. And to help us kind of fill in the picture, we have extraordinary historian and just all-around great guy, Stephen Weidekoff, joined us. Stephen Weidekoff is a lecturer of church history at Christendom College Graduate School of Theology and the author of Glory of the Crusades and the Real Story of Catholic History from Catholic Answers Press. He's also the creator, by the way, and author of Epic, A Journey Through Church History, which is an adult faith formation program about the 2,000 years history of the church. And by the way, he has an awesome new book out. You guys need to check this out. I'm holding it in my hands for those watching live stream. It is Timeless, A History of the Catholic Church by Our Sunday Visitor. It's a great read. And Stephen Weidekoff, welcome to Hands on Apologetics.
Thanks, Gary, for having me on the show. Glad to be here. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing great. How are things down south?
Well, it's pretty hot, but we had some torrential rain yesterday in the area, but
yikes.
Besides that, it's going well.
Yeah, that's pretty much the description up here in Michigan. Well, Steve, like I mentioned before, yesterday was the 500th anniversary of the second Leipzig debate between Luther and Johann Eck. And, you know, unfortunately, we could only cover that, but we really didn't talk about what is the Protestant Reformation. How did it come about? Why don't we start there? What was some of the causes that led to Martin Luther's revolt against the church?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, there's a lot that kind of leads up to that. So I always like to start, you know, telling the story and setting the historical context for the Protestant revolt by actually going backwards in time to the 14th century. And some people might think, well, why are we going back 200 years, you know, from the events of Luther and his ilk? But really, I think the roots of that revolt stem there. And what happens in the 14th century are two major events in the papacy that really cause a significant problem for all of Christendom with the popes and the papacy. And that those are two things. One, the first is in the early part of the 14th century, in 1308, 1309, the pope moves his residence from Rome to the south of France, to Avignon. And so you have what's known as the Avignon Papacy. And so really what's happening here is the Pope is participating in one of the numerous ecclesiastical abuses that were prevalent at that time, and that actually go all the way into the 16th century. It's abuse known as absenteeism, where a bishop doesn't actually physically reside in his diocese. So you can imagine how that would be difficult for people, you know, today, let alone, you know, several hundred years ago, when you don't have a bishop, no resident bishop. The sacraments obviously suffer, you know, confirmation can suffer, ordinations, and it's just a great scandal, obviously, if a local bishop did it. But, you know, imagine the Pope doing it, which is what happened. I mean, how much of a universal scandal that was. So that's one issue. The second issue was in the same century, in the 15th century, or 14th century, eventually the popes come back to Rome, primarily through the actions of St. Catherine of Siena, who basically, you know, through her sanctity and through her directness, basically called the popes to come back to Rome. And eventually Clement the 11th does. And when he comes back, or I'm sorry, Gregory the 11th, when he comes back to Rome, he dies soon thereafter. And then you have the situation, what becomes known in history as the Great Western Schism, where you have one man who's elected pope, Urban the 6th, but he's very, you know, very difficult, irascible man to deal with. And eventually the cardinals say that they were coerced by the Italian/Roman mob to elect him because he was an Italian, and the Italians didn't want a Frenchman elected because they feared he would take the papacy back to France. So then you have an anti-pope elected, and eventually at one point when you get into the early part of the 15th century, you have two anti-popes. So there's three men claiming to be pope at the same time. And obviously, as you can imagine, this causes great scandal. The papacy is supposed to be a source of unity in the church. Instead, in the 15th century, it's a source of disunity. And so all of that leads into culminating with the Renaissance popes, which happened afterwards here in the latter part of the 15th century into the 16th century, where you have the popes who are you know, acting more like universe or acting more like Renaissance princes than they are as the universal shepherd. And that combined with all these ecclesiastical abuses like absenteeism, nepotism is very prevalent in this age, in this historical time period as well, where you have popes appointing their nephews and other relatives to important posts within the curia, the papal court. You have other problems such as, you know, pluralism, which is one bishop, one man who's the bishop of multiple dioceses. So there's a lot of corruption and problems within the church. And then you have this you know, university professor in northern Germany, you know, an Augustinian monk, who decides he has some theological issues with the doctrine of indulgences, with a lot of the corruption that's going on, and so he posts these 95 theses, or publishes them in October 1517. That kind of gets the whole Protestant revolt going.
Yeah. So you know what I love about it, and this is one of the things I love about your new book, Timeless History of the Catholic Church, is you think things are bad now. You just have to read about the 14th and 15th century, and you could really see corruption.
Oh, yeah, that's so true. I mean, that's a great point. I mean, I try to make this point whenever I give talks and things, you know, about various episodes in church history, and people ask me about the current crisis, and, you know, it's bad, obviously, and there's things that need to be addressed and dealt with, and, you know, in the modern church, obviously, in the modern-day church, but you know, like you said, I mean, there have been, when you read and study the history of the church, there have been times when things have been way worse than they are now, and so hopefully that gives us a bit of solace, right, that we can take from that. This understanding that you know, Christ is present in the church. He sent the Holy Spirit. The Holy Spirit at Pentecost. The Holy Spirit guides, guards, and animates the church, and has for 2,000 years. Does so still today, and will until Christ comes again. So we can take some hope and solace from that, I think.
Yes, absolutely. Now, one thing I didn't realize is around the time Luther comes on the scene, Germany wasn't really like a well-defined state, was it? It was kind of just coming into its own.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, and that's one of the major kind of factors that helps to further the Protestant rebellion, actually, is the fact that there is no united Germany. I mean, the whole idea of a united nation named Germany doesn't really come into existence until the late 19th century, frankly.
Yeah, so I was shocked.
It's at the time of Luther in the 16th century, there's, you know, over 300 different dukedoms, principalities, free city-states. It's a hodgepodge collection of different areas or different, you know, kind of political organizations, which eventually in the 19th century become the nation of Germany. But at the time, it wasn't. So, you know, nominally you had these areas kind of somewhat governed or controlled by, it's very nominally, by the Holy Roman Emperor, who at the time of Luther was a very young Charles, you know, Charles V, who was also King of Spain at the time as well, since Charles I there. So that leads to a lot of, and even at the time of Luther in the 16th century, although it's not a united area, there is a lot of, and growing German nationalism, such that Luther is actually influenced by a lot of this kind of rhetoric and propaganda at the time, especially from the writer Ulrich von Hutten. And von Hutten is one of these who really rails against the papacy, who rails against the fact that in these German areas you have all this money, you know, flowing down to Rome. You have all this, you know, Rome has a lot of influence in the German areas because there is no kind of united nation. There is no united monarchy. There is no one king that kind of speaks for all of Germany. Again, the Holy Roman Emperor is there in Charles V, but again, he's very much united with the Pope in Rome in most cases. So the people and a lot of the merchants and some of these petty, you know, princes and dukes felt as if they didn't have as much authority in their own political areas as other places of Europe did, other like France and England and even Italy in some cases. So they were upset with that, and they were upset with Rome, and that kind of led to a lot of the kindling, which helped to ignite the fire of the Protestant revolt.
Yeah, very good. Well, what can you tell us? We have about 4 minutes left. What can you tell us about Martin Luther? Where did he come from? What was his influences?
Yeah, Luther, you know, was a Saxon, so he's from you know, the Electoral Saxony at this time. He's which is, you know, northern northeastern Germany, modern day Germany. You know, he comes from a kind of we would call him a lower middle class family. His father was a miner. And actually, you know, worked his way up to actually owning several different copper mines and things like that in that area. But he was Luther was known from his childhood to be very brilliant and very smart. So his father wanted him to be educated, so he was sent off to university. Dad wanted him to be a lawyer, but he had this great religious conversion experience in 1505 when he was coming home from a break at the university and engulfed in this major thunderstorm. Thought he was going to die. You know, lightning struck near him. He was thrown to the ground, and he uttered this prayer: "Help me, Saint Anne, I'll become a monk." So he prayed to the mother of our Blessed Mother and asked that if he was to be saved from the storm, that he would enter the monastery. So he did. He lived through the storm. He kept his promise, entered into the Augustinian monastery, and became eventually a doctor, had got a doctorate in theology with an emphasis and expertise in the scriptures, and then was sent to the town of Wittenberg, again in northeastern Germany, where he, over the early part of the 16th century, began to delve into the writings of St. Paul in particular, and tried to wrestle with this question of, you know, salvation. How do I know that I'm saved? And because that was something that he was very obsessed with. And he began to interpret Paul's letters in a way that was not in keeping with the Orthodox understanding of those of the letters and the doctrines contained within them, and that kind of put him on the path to heresy.
Yeah, very good. And also he had scruples. He always felt like he was condemned by God. You know, I often wonder, Steve, if wasn't his friend? Didn't he get killed by lightning during that storm?
I don't think I've heard that particular aspect of the story. I know that there was another incident when he was coming home from break, and he actually was playing with his dagger, and Luther was playing with his dagger and like, you know, cut his leg very severely. And so he had a lot of traumatic experiences, and he came from a home that was abusive, both physically and verbally as a kid. So he had a lot of traumatic experiences as a child, and that kind of led to his understanding of God, and seeing God as not a loving and kind and merciful father, but really as a wrathful, vengeful judge. And that plays a very big role, his comprehension of who he believed God was, in the development of his later heretical theology.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, because I know there's been some writings by psychiatrists who have put Luther on the couch, so to speak. And his upbringing, lots of events in his life ultimately form his character. And like you said, when he was in the monastery, he had these qualms of conscience where he never felt forgiven by God, that God was kind of a ruthless dictator.
Yeah, very true. I mean, there's stories of him, you know, in the monastery, right, going to confession frequently, and not just frequently in terms of, you know, once a week or so, but I mean, actual stories of him going to confession, coming out 5-10 minutes later, going right back into the confessional because he thought he forgot something. And at one point, his spiritual director said to him, you know, you need to understand that God is not, you are angry with God. God is not angry with you. But that didn't seem to placate him at all.
Very good. We're talking with Stephen Weidenkopf about the Protestant Reformation. Stay tuned, folks. More on the other side of the break.
This is Terry Barber reminding you, there's a women's conference coming up September 7th, 2019 at the Sacred Heart Chapel. Mary Danielle Barber will be speaking along with Barbara Nicolosi. They're going to be talking about true femininity, be who you are. This is going to be for your daughters, your mothers. Every woman should be at this conference. And the way to do it is go to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
This is Jesse Romero. You're listening to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda on Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
And welcome back, everybody. We're chatting with Steve Wadenkopf, author of the book Timeless, History of the Catholic Church. And we're talking specifically about the Protestant Revolt. And up before the break, we were chatting about the corruption within the church that ultimately led to Luther's personal struggles with the church. Tell us a little bit about the 95 Theses.
Yeah, so, you know, the 95 Theses are this document that Luther publishes, you know, late October 31st, actually, of 1517. And it's in this theses that he enumerates these 95 different positions or commentary on various teachings of the church. And most of them, not all of them, but most of them have to deal with the doctrine of indulgences. And in particular, Luther... You know, a lot of times people think that, and the main Protestant narrative in particular centers on the fact that Luther got into trouble with the church because he called into question the so-called selling of indulgences, where what happens, you know, historically speaking, is right before Luther publishes this document, you know, a couple years before, actually, Pope Leo X, actually it was begun under Pope Julius II, he wanted to rebuild St. Peter's Basilica in Rome. And so one way in which obviously that's going to cost a lot of money. So one way in which to help finance the construction of that building is the rebuilding was Julius allowed people throughout Christendom to receive a plenary indulgence when they gave alms, when they gave a voluntary charitable contribution to the church. They could receive, as a result of that penitential offering of almsgiving, they could receive a plenary indulgence. And again, that helped to generate, and that with the understanding that the money generated from the almsgiving would go to Rome and would help build the Basilica of St. Peter's in Rome. Now, after Julius II dies, the next Pope, Leo X, continues that practice. And so here we are, you know, early part of the 16th century. Luther is a professor of theology at the University of Wittenberg. And you have these indulgence preachers who are commissioned and sent out from Rome, with the bishop's permission of each local diocese. They go into the diocese and they preach this indulgence. This, you know, again, you give an alms, a penitential, voluntary monetary contribution, you can receive a plenary indulgence. Unfortunately, some of these preachers did not, you know, authentically present the church's doctrine on indulgences. And many times they preyed on the ignorance of common people about their understanding. I mean, obviously the common people were not theologians. They don't understand the doctrine. If it's not taught to them correctly, they can believe many different things. And so many of these preachers actually, you know, kind of preyed on that ignorance and said things that just weren't true and weren't in keeping with what the church actually teaches about indulgences. And so they would kind of give the understanding to the common people that, you know, give me some money and you can get out of purgatory free kind of card, either for yourself or for your loved ones, you know, for lack of a better term. And you know, again, that's corruption, that's abuse. The key point there, though, is that was not official church teaching at the time. It's not church teaching now. It never was. So it's an abuse. And not every indulgence preacher was like that, but some were. And so, you know, Luther hears of this and he gets very angry, and he has a problem with the doctrine of indulgences as a whole anyways. And in particular, his problem with it, and there were others at this time who didn't like what these indulgence preachers were doing, and they also had issues with it, and they, you know, called it into question, but they stayed true to the church's fundamental teachings. What Luther does is Luther goes off, you know, on the other end and begins to question the doctrine itself. And more specifically, you know, one of the things that the doctrine of indulgences is kind of centered on is papal authority, right? That we believe as Catholics that the Pope has the authority given to the successors of Peter by Christ to grant this indulgence, to dispense from the treasury of graces by that authority. You know, the Pope has that authority through Peter, through Christ. So Luther says, no, that's not true. The Pope has no authority whatsoever to grant grace from the treasury of graces through these indulgences. And that's not correcting an abuse. That's not correcting, you know, this individual or these, you know, the indulgence preachers who are out here preaching heresy, or at least, you know, at the worst, but at the best, they're preying on the ignorance of people. Rather, that's an actual attack on the fundamental doctrine of the church, which is, you know, lends one to heresy. So he publishes these theses, right? Eventually, a copy of them is sent to Rome. There's a theologian, the papal theologian in Rome reviews the document, recognizes that there are many errors within them. Now, there's some of these theses that are not erroneous, but many are. And so Luther is actually, a letter is sent to him to come to Rome to answer, you know, about his particular teachings in this document. He refuses to come, says he's sick. He's afraid that if he goes to Rome, he's going to be hauled before the Inquisition and perhaps, you know, ultimately, bad things would happen to him. So he doesn't go. So eventually the Pope sends a representative, Cardinal Cajetan is his name, to go to Germany. He's there on a diplomatic mission as well, but he also goes and talks to Luther about his theses and tries to get him to recant his erroneous heretical teachings. And Luther refuses to do so, and that, again, kind of gets that puts Luther then into squarely on the side of heresy, and that's when he gets himself into significant trouble.
Yeah, about what time did he meet with Cajetan, roughly?
Yeah, Cajetan is 1518, so it's, you know, he publishes these okay. theses, 95 theses, at the end of 1517, right in the fall, in October. And then by the time Cajetan gets there and talks to him, I believe it was the summer of 1518 is when Cajetan is in Germany, and then they have their meeting. And then a year later, right, 1519, as you were mentioning at the top of the show, is when he has that debate with Eck at Leipzig.
Yeah, very good. It's my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't Rome not really take Luther very seriously, that they thought it was just a squabble with the Augustinians and, they didn't really fully appreciate the potential danger, I guess you could say, of Luther's vendetta against the church?
Yeah, I think that's definitely true of Leo X. I mean, Leo is the Pope at the time, right? So he's made aware of, by Prierius, who's the papal theologian at the time, you know, that, oh, here's this document from this monk in, you know, up in Germany that's got these problems with the doctrine of indulgences, whether these are heretical, you know, and so Leo was, I think, apt to kind of, you know, he's the last of the Renaissance popes, and so, you know, he's more focused, again, on kind of temporal things, earthly things, than he is spiritual things, and there is some thought that he just kind of saw this whole thing as just an issue between religious orders, because most of the indulgence preachers at the time were Dominicans. Luther's an Augustinian. So there's some thought that, you know, okay, the Pope thought there was just some kind of jealousy between the religious orders here. And he doesn't take it as serious, perhaps, as in hindsight we would have liked him to do. But I think that kind of, we have to be careful with that characterization, because I think that kind of makes it seem as if the church really didn't do anything. But that's not true. I mean, his erroneous doctrines were highlighted to the Pope, right? He was asked to recant. He refused to do so. The Pope sent his envoy to Germany to talk with him. Cajetan talks with him. Luther doesn't recant. Then you have the debate with Eck. He still doesn't recant. And then eventually in 1520, Pope Leo issues the bull Exsurge Domini, which condemns 41 specific teachings of Luther that are heretical, that were heretical, and gives him 60 days to recant, again, which he refuses to do. So, there's a process in the church. I mean, as much as we would like, the Pope or a bishop or a council to be convened immediately and to kind of squash heresy as it arises, you know, it takes time, right? The Pope or the church is always focused on the charity, of the individual, soul. And so, allows time for, kind of a going back, especially among theologians and professors, time to go back and forth, to discuss their writings. Are you sure this is what you meant? I mean, here's really what the church teaches. Are you sure you still mean this and that you really want to hold on to that particular, heretical doctrine? And if so, okay, well, now we're going to do, now we investigate the possibility of putting ecclesiastical, penalties upon you. So there's a process, and it takes time.
Yeah, and that's good. I mean, Matthew 18, Jesus says, if you see a brother sinning, go to him. won't listen to you, take another person. If you won't listen to them, take them to the church. You know, yeah, the care of the soul is important, hoping that they'll repent and come back rather than just, you know, if you see somebody sinning, take them to the church and it'll be excommunicated.
Exactly, right. I mean, and that's, yeah, that's crucially important. And you'll see that later, too, just, you know, to go forward into time in the middle part of the 16th century when the Council of Trent is called. And you look at how Trent, you know, reiterates church teaching in all of these areas that, that were under attack by various Protestant, you know, revolutionaries, Luther, Calvin, Zwingli, others. You won't find, you know, in the decrees of the Council of Trent, the name of Luther or the name of Calvin or the name of Zwingli. They don't, you know, the church doesn't attack the individual, rather, you know, but hopes and prays for that individual's repentance and for the mercy of God and that they would return to the church. The church instead attacks their erroneous teachings, their erroneous doctrines. That's what's the issue.
Very good. So how was the excommunication carried out? Is this the Diet of Worms?
So, yeah, two things. So exactly the way we have to keep in mind historically, right, that at this time, heresy is kind of a twofold crime. It's not only a crime against the church, it's an ecclesiastical crime, but it's also a crime against the state, right? Most against the secular ruler. So there were, you know, two different ways in which a person, you know, could be identified and called a heretic. You know, one was through the church, you know, especially if one goes through the inquisitorial process, which Luther did not. But Luther was, again, that bull, Leo X, issued that bull, Exsurge Domini, in 1520, asked Luther to recant. He refused to do so. In fact, he actually took a copy of the bull, along with other church writings, and burned a copy of the bull, along with the other writings, outside the town of Wittenberg, and basically told his followers to not follow it. He actually wrote a pamphlet called Against the Execrable Bull of the Antichrist, where he refers to Leo X as Antichrist and for issuing this condemnation of his writings. So he burns the bull. So that places him now, since he's defied the Pope, that's the ecclesiastical, you know, issue of, and so he incurs the penalty of excommunication. But now, because heresy is also a secular crime, and in most cases it was a capital offense, meaning it was punishable by death, then the secular authorities get involved, and that happens, as you mentioned, at the Diet of Worms the following year in 1521. Luther is called to the Diet by the Holy Roman Emperor Charles V, and, you know, the Diet is just this kind of, you know, not really a legislative, but a representative assembly of, you know, various important personages, princes, and dukes throughout Germany, and they meet to discuss the issue of Luther.
Okay, very good. We're talking with Steve Weinkopf about the Protestant Reformation. Stay tuned, folks. We'll find out what happened.
This is Terry Barber reminding you, there's a women's conference coming up September 7th, 2019 at the Sacred Heart Chapel. Mary Danielle Barber will be speaking along with Barbara Nicolosi. They're going to be talking about true femininity, be who you are. This is going to be for your daughters, your mothers. Every woman should be at this conference. And the way to do it is go to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Matsuda. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
And welcome back, everybody. We are chatting with Stephen Weidenkopf about the Protestant Reformation. And by the way, he has a new book out that I highly recommend if you want a quick read of 2,000 years of church history. It's called Timeless, A History of the Catholic Church by Our Sunday Visitor. And it's great stuff. And so, Steve, over and over again, the church condemned Luther, met with Luther. Luther kept refusing, pushed back. Finally, at the Diet of Worms, you have this imperial assembly of secular and religious, I suppose. And that's when basically he gets the excommunication is executed, right?
Well, yeah, actually, I mean, before the Diet meets, he receives the official, you know, bull of excommunication from the church. Yeah. But then, so that's the, we were talking about it before, right, before the break, that there's the twofold understanding of heresy as a crime. So that's the, that takes care of kind of the church aspect of it, right? So from the church, Luther's been excommunicated. Then he has an opportunity at the Diet of Worms to discuss, you know, the secular issue of heresy, and given another opportunity, frankly, to recant when he's at the Diet in front of the Holy Roman Emperor. And he refuses to do so. I mean, first he's brought before this great assembly and, you know, a pile of books a copy of his books, actually, you know, copies of his books are on the table in front of him. And he's asked to recant his writings. And he says, well, give me a day, give me some time to think about whether I want to do that or not. And so they kind of humorously, I mean, he's already been excommunicated by the church, but okay, we'll give you another opportunity. And so the Holy Roman Emperor Charles V gave him a day, said, you've got one day to go think about it again and come back in the next morning and tell us what your answer is. And so the next morning he comes before the Diet and then steadfastly refuses to recant his teachings. And so as a result of that, he then is declared a heretic by the secular authority. So, which again, liables him to be arrested and to be punished secularly for the crime of heresy. And the secular punishment for heresy was death and usually burning at the stake. Now, since Luther had received the safe conduct pass from the emperor to go to the Diet, that allowed him to leave the Diet as well under a safe conduct pass. So he, meaning that he's given 2 weeks with which to leave and go back to his home free from arrest or from imprisonment and things like that. So, but after the 2 weeks is up, then, you know, forget it. He can be arrested and then punished by the secular authority. So he leaves the Diet, and on his way home, he's kidnapped, and kind of, you've got to put kidnap in quotations, because his home secular ruler, a man by the name of Elector Frederick, hatched a plan to kidnap Luther and put him into this castle at the Wartburg, this Wartburg castle, and kind of keep him out of the way and hide him from the imperial authority so he couldn't be killed. And so that's what happens. So he spends some time in this castle, and he grows his beard, and he wears, you know, takes off his habit. He wears, you know, secular clothing, not religious clothing anymore. Actually goes by an alias as well, calls himself Junker George. But while he's in the castle, he begins then his translation of the New Testament initially, and then later the Old Testament into German.
Okay. Yeah, very good. So he's essentially kind of in hiding under his patron. We would think that would probably be the end of his story, right? But what goes on after that?
No, he continues to, he's never arrested by the imperial authority. So because primarily, again, because his secular ruler, Elector Frederick, harbors him, really, refuses to turn him over to the imperial authorities. And again, because Germany, it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, because this area is not united and there's no, you know, king with lots of power, the Holy Roman Emperor has nominal power in these areas. The secular individual authorities, you know, have a lot of power in their own realms for the most part. They didn't have power of the church. That's kind of one of the things that they wanted. So many of them, including, you know, Elector Frederick, they begin to kind of use Luther and use his teachings to revolt, frankly, against the church. And so you have many of these secular rulers over the next few years will declare openly and say that they're Protestant or they're Lutheran, that they agree with Luther's teachings. They'll confiscate church lands and church territory and church property in their realm. And you know, you'll have this not only does that happen among the princes and nobility, but also you see a rise in violence throughout these German areas. So there, in 1525, there's this event called the Peasants' Revolt, which is somewhat of a misnomer because it wasn't just peasants that participated in it, but there were large numbers of peasants as well as free citizens and merchants and others who rose up against secular authority because Luther's writings calling for people to revolt against the church could easily be applied to the secular authorities, and they were. So people revolted against the secular authorities. So then you have this big revolt in 1525, which is causing all kinds of property destruction, both among, you know, church property and secular property as well, to the point that these princes and these secular rulers that are harboring Luther from the imperial authorities and from the church come to him and say, you know, hey, the peasants are revolting because of your writing, so you got to do something about that. So Luther writes publishes a pamphlet, rather, in 1525 called Against the Murderous, Thieving Hordes of Peasants.
Great title.
great title, yeah. In which he advocates the nobility to go and violently put down this rebellion. And they do. And so, you know, one historian has estimated that over nearly 130,000 peasants were killed throughout all these German territories. You know, primarily because Luther, you know, had urged the nobility to do it and said it was okay to go and kill them and put the revolt down. So that's what happened. So, you know, he continues on. There's some other meetings that occur that, you know, Luther doesn't participate in, but many of his followers do. There's a diet in Speyer, in the city of Speyer in 1529, when Protestants actually get their name Protestant. What happens at that diet is the Holy Roman Emperor wants, you know, so kind of religious war in a certain sense breaks out in certain areas of these German territories. And so at this Diet of Speyer in 1529 now, the Holy Roman Emperor Charles V still wants peace. And so he issues an edict at this diet that says that the Mass should be celebrated and must be allowed to be celebrated in all German territories. Because what had happened is you had these areas that had kind of turned Protestant or turned Lutheran, and they would kick out the church. They'd, you know, force the priests and religious out of the areas. They'd confiscate church property and land, and then they would ban the celebration of Mass and the celebration of sacraments. And so that was causing all kinds of issues, obviously, and violence. And so the emperor, in a way to try to prevent that, said, look, the Mass is allowed to be celebrated and should be celebrated all throughout German territory. But there were several different cities and several different German territories that were against that edict. And so they protested that edict. They protested the celebration of Mass in their territories. And so as a result of that, they then get the moniker, or they get the name Protestant, those who protested the celebration of the Mass. And that happens in 1529. So Luther is not present at that diet, but, you know, there are people there that support him that are. And so he continues to kind of, you know, stay in the background. I mean, he continues in a certain sense. He continues to write. He's a very prolific writer. Publishes all kinds of different treatises on all kinds of different subjects, on monastic vows, for example. He encourages religious to leave their monasteries and convents, which actually does happen in Germany in large numbers. He throws off his promise of celibacy and actually gets married to a runaway nun. Catherine von Bora has many children with her. Continues to rail against the church and the church's teachings, writing all kinds of pamphlets, even actually writes pamphlets against the Jews. He was a voracious anti-Semite, did not like the Jewish people, and wanted them either forcibly converted or forcibly expelled from German territories. So he lives a very interesting rest of his life for the next 20-some-odd years, dies in 1546 after suffering a stroke.
Yeah. Yeah, and from what I understand, the anti-Semitism really comes out near the end of his life, doesn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I think it was there, you know, in many ways throughout his life. But yeah, it really comes out at the end. It's toward the end of his life, within the last, you know, 5 years or so of his life, where he publishes his pamphlet Against the Jews and Their Lies, is what he titled it.
Yeah. Very good. Yeah. You put it so well, because we often forget that the Protestant revolt would not have succeeded had it not been for German princes, you know, to back it up. And so you end up with a divided Germany, with different areas being Lutheran, areas being Catholic.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's what we know, what began and what started as a theological revolution from Luther's teachings against the church, you know, then devolves into, as you put it, this, you know, this kind of political revolution as well. And then it ultimately fractures, you know, Germany into, and the areas of what becomes Germany into, you know, Catholic and Protestant, sadly. And so that's still even prevalent in German society today, where, you know, most northern parts of Germany and the German states are Protestant, and most of the, you know, the southern states, especially Bavaria, remain Catholic.
Yeah, very good. Wow, I feel like I took a master's level class in medieval history. This is great. Helped me fill in a lot of blanks. Stephen, where can people go to, you know, find out what you're doing, what books you've written, articles, things you're doing?
Yeah, the best place to go is, I have my own website, so it's just stevewydenkopf.com, all one word there, my name. And on there, I list, you know, I have references for people for all the books that I've written. Obviously, people can go to Catholic Answers, that published a couple of my books, and Our Sunday Visitors, you mentioned as well, published my most recent book, Timeless. And on my website, I have all of the, I write occasionally a blog post or articles for the Catholic Answers magazine online as well. And all the ones that I've written over the last several years are on my website as well, archived there, so people can find those if they have questions about various historical topics.
All right. Wow. That's great. Yeah. Go to stevewydenkopf.com, all one word. And Steve, thank you so much for being on the program. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, my pleasure, Gary. It's great talking to you again.
All right. That's Steve Wydenkopf, folks. And again, it's stevewydenkopf.com is the name of his website. And you want to access his work, because Steve's done some really great work in history, and also in focusing on all those issues, historical issues that we run into while we're defending the faith. Really good stuff. So check it out if you can. So fun continues, folks. Tomorrow, we're going to have Master Apologist Bobby Hesley come back into the dojo. Bobby's going to join us. We're going to talk about the Eucharist. And I know you're familiar with him. He always has really great information, very interesting takes on how to explain the defend the faith. So it's always great to have him on board. And man, I tell you, this is the fastest hour on Catholic Talk Radio. It just flies, folks. But I appreciate everybody tuning in. It's been a lot of fun. Coming up next, High Impact Catholic Talk, coming at you with the Terry and Jesse Show. And for me, it's time to turn down the lights here at the dojo and shut down the Midwest Command Center and turn the power back to the world headquarters there in Covina, California. Thank you so much for listening, folks. And God willing, we'll talk to you again tomorrow. Have a great, blessed day. Bye-bye, everybody.
In the 1990s, I lived and worked in Hollywood. But when my wife Betty's mom took ill, we relocated to Orange County. And it was during this time in our lives that I converted to Catholicism. Once my eyes were opened to the truth, I couldn't learn enough about the faith. But I had less free time than ever, especially with a long commute. That's when I discovered the real value of Catholic audio. Listening to cassette tapes transformed my daily commute into a miniature retreat. And that's the beauty of Virgin Most Powerful Radio today. Since the podcasts are archived, you can listen anytime on our smartphone app. I know how listening to Catholic audio can bring you closer to Christ and His Church. So I encourage you to visit the App Store or go to vmpr.org and download the app today. It just might change your life. I'm Matthew Arnold for Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
Virgin Most Powerful Radio. sharing the gospel with clarity and charity.